The Rush, Digging into Addiction, is made possible through a grant from the Binghamton Rotary Charities and the generous support of listeners like you. Thanks for your support.
Welcome to The Rush, Digging into Addiction, a WSKG News special. I'm Crystal Sirakis. You probably heard about the supervised injection site Ithaca proposed last winter, a place where people could inject heroin more safely. We're going to talk to one of the people behind that proposal, but first we go across the continent to Vancouver, Canada, the city with the first legal supervised injection site in North America. It's called Insight, and despite many attempts to shut it down, it's now in its 13th year of operation. Supporters say it saved thousands of lives and opened the door to health care and safety for the city's most vulnerable people. Reporter Pamela Post tells us more.
It's the last Wednesday of the month in the downtown east side of Vancouver, the day when thousands of people living on the margins in this community get their monthly social assistance checks. The streets are full of activity, much of it drug-related. 38-year-old Kelly Lubers has just used the clean and clinical facilities at Insight to inject her daily dose of speed and heroin. She's not after a high, she says, just a maintenance dose to keep her from getting sick from withdrawal. She's sitting on a bench in a community garden next to the Insight building. She tells me about the time she overdosed on the potent synthetic opioid fentanyl and how the nurses at Insight saved her life.
I seized a seizure and dropped dead, I guess. And if it wasn't for Insight, I'd be dead.
She's here in the toughest section of the downtown east side, the poorest urban area in Canada, in the heart of one of the country's richest cities. Kelly is one of an estimated 5,000 IV drug users here. Operators of Insight say there will almost certainly be overdoses here today, but no one will die because they're injecting under the watchful eyes of medical staff. Kelly Lubers says her drug consumption levels have gone down dramatically since she started coming to Insight 5 years ago.
I can actually say a couple of the nurses are my real friends. They're not just doing their job and amusing me. They actually consider themselves my friend. That means a lot to somebody that's an addict and that gets judged constantly and looked down at constantly.
Insight sees between 800 and 1,200 people a day for injection.
Dr. Christy Sutherland is in her downtown Eastside medical office. Her sweatshirt has an image of a hypodermic needle. The caption reads, Insight saves lives. Sutherland is the primary care physician here.
There's never been a death at Insight, but there's been countless overdoses. And each of these overdoses has been intervened quite quickly with a nurse, and so the person's life has been saved.
And dozens of articles and studies in peer-reviewed medical journals back her up. So do local public health officials and the Vancouver police. But skepticism remains. The mayor of Surrey, a sprawling municipality next door, has her reservations about calls for a supervised injection site in her city. In a recent radio interview, Linda Heppner says she wants more proof the sites actually help people get off drugs.
I have no data around how those injection sites have really moved people off narcotics and into a safer lifestyle.
But Dr. Sutherland says supervised injection sites save lives, reduce transmission of HIV, Hep C, and bring people to treatment. But what about the community? On the streets outside Insight on check day, there was a lot of drug use, police presence, and chaos.
Basically what you see, you know, is kind of an open drug trade. And some people using in the alleys, but still there's mayhem. So some people could go down there and go, you know what, it's still a zoo down here. Mm-hmm. So what is Insight doing?
We know that Insight has not increased drug trafficking and it has not increased the amount of drug use in the downtown east side. And I think people mistakenly think that when they see chaos, that Insight or often social housing gets blamed on it, whereas that chaos was there and that suffering was there, and that our job is to create a safe space to bring it indoors.
With the current opioid crisis in North America, there's an urgency to find solutions. Many towns and cities are looking to the Insight model. Even Mayor Heppner is now rethinking her skepticism after a recent spate of overdoses in her community. In addition to Insight, there's a residential detox facility on the second floor. Hundreds of injection drug users every year ask for and get treatment for their addiction just upstairs. Kelly Lubers is hoping to be one of them.
I'm supposed to go into detox next week. I'm not sure if it'll happen. I'm going to pray all week to God that he gives me the strength to do it, because I finally feel like I can start my life again.
Insight has managed to keep its doors open since 2003, despite years of opposition from Canada's former Conservative government. A new Liberal government under Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has lauded Insight and its work. But despite Vancouver's experience, supervised injection sites remain a political hot potato. Federal law currently requires extensive legal proof of community support before any new site in Canada can open its doors. In spite of its vocal support, the Trudeau government has so far refused calls to remove those hurdles. For WSKG News, I'm Pamela Post in Vancouver.
You're listening to The Rush, Digging into Addiction here on WSKG. I'm Crystal Sirakis. Joining me in the studio is New York State Senator Tom O'Meara. Senator, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And John Barry with the Southern Tier AIDS Program is also with us today. John, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
So can I get your reactions to the piece that we just heard? And Senator, we can start with you.
Well, I certainly share the skepticism of the value of having a supervised injection site. I know it's been an issue that's been raised in Ithaca within the 58th Senate District that I represent. However, I have strong concerns as a former prosecutor myself that continuing to allow the use of illegal narcotics, supervised or unsupervised, is not the focus we should have. We certainly have a well-recognized heroin crisis across our state, and we should be doing everything we can to alleviate the use of narcotics and not encourage that by having a safe zone for someone to come and inject an illegal narcotic. You know, we worked very hard in the last 2 years in the legislature and trying to come up with ways to combat the heroin epidemic, and we've got, I think, a lot more to do before we get to the point where I think we seriously consider having an injection site. I haven't seen the huge groundswell of support throughout the district for that type of thinking, and you know, have strong reservations in encouraging that.
John?
It's been an interesting discussion for me, because all the reservations and difficulties that people have with this idea are exactly the same difficulties that were voiced when we initially opened up our syringe exchange programs. You know, people felt that it was going to worsen the drug problem, that it was going to lead to more crime, and the whole litany of things that you hear. People are going to move here so that they can more easily use drugs. None of those things have materialized. They have not happened. It's that straightforward and plain and simple. What I do hear is people saying that they are very, very concerned about people overdosing and dying. And I think if we are genuinely concerned about that, then there is an intervention that can prevent that. They are doing it in 100 different places, 66 cities, 10 different countries throughout the world, and have been for over two decades. This is not a new idea. There's nothing radical going on here. The focus is on assuring that people are safe, that they live long enough to quit using drugs. The push is to get them into treatment and to make sure that their basic needs are met.
Do you see that there is, though, a lot of concern from community members about this idea of giving people a place to shoot up in the community?
I think we've been so indoctrinated by 40 years of the war on drugs that we can't even think straight in this country about a rational approach to drug policy. You know, one of the things that I've also been noticing as we have this discussion is even law enforcement officers are now saying we can't arrest our way out of this problem. And at the same time that they're saying that, you know, you look at county budgets. Broome County is an excellent example here locally. One of the only parts of our budget that went up this latest year was we are going to add on to the county jail and we're going to hire 13 new deputies. It's a failed policy. It has never worked. It continues to not work, and it is the most expensive way of dealing with the problem. And we have siphoned money off from treatment and prevention for decades, and now we are surprised that we don't have any money to use in those areas.
Senator?
I agree with John that law enforcement agrees as well that we cannot arrest our way out of this. I think there's a very strong new approach that we're seeing, and Broome County is a leader in that area with law enforcement working with the community to divert individuals caught for possession of narcotics into programs to get them directed towards getting off of their addiction. We certainly have seen an effort in the state budget, as I mentioned before, with increasing funding. We've got a long ways to go. We recently saw, I think it was 30 new inpatient beds opened in Tompkins County to aid with this. We've got a lot more to go with that, and I think our resources will be better directed at treatment services and other alternatives than continuing the use of narcotics in a safe zone. I think the fact that we're even talking about this certainly shows the extent of the problem that we have in our communities, and we're all grasping at ways to try to solve this. We don't want to see anyone overdosing and dying from the use of illegal narcotics, but there are plenty of treatment programs that we are going to have to open up. The increased funding will help that. It's not going to be an overnight problem, and it's a whole community effort it's going to take to solve this. But we have, I think, some new inroads with some alternative drugs to take, with Suboxone and Vivitrol, or even the old-fashioned methadone, to make those things more accessible.
Senator, the former district attorney of Tompkins County, Gwen Wilkinson, said at first that she called the idea insane at first, but she's since come around to it. What do you think about her change on this?
I haven't had a chance to talk to Gwen about her change. You know, Ithaca is unique in the southern tier of Finger Lakes region for its progressive outlook on things. I can't say that I'm shocked that she came around and changed her opinion of that, but I haven't had an opportunity to talk to her. I have not seen the light, I guess you might say, Crystal, with regards to this. I haven't. And my reaction was similar to Gwen's. I don't think I used the word insane when I first heard about it, but I know I did a radio interview and thought it was a pretty outrageous idea. And since then, and it's been, you know, at least 6 months now, I think, or longer since that was proposed, I have not heard of any groundswell of support through the 58th Senate District that I represent, that people think this is a good idea.
The New York Times quoted you as calling it preposterous.
Yeah, that's not insane, but I know I did. Okay, so preposterous. I do recall using that word. Yeah.
Well, is there anything that would make you take a second look at this?
I'm always open, and that's why I'm here today to discuss this with John and you on this. I think it's going to take a lot of community feedback for something like this to possibly be successful. It's going to have to take a huge buy-in from the community, and I think that we haven't done enough in our fight against the heroin addictions with conventional tools that we have through treatment, making more treatment available, and these alternative drugs to wean an individual off their addiction.
I want to take just a moment, Senator, putting your own personal views aside, to take us through what would have to happen in Albany to make this a legal option.
I'm not sure if it certainly would take change in state laws. And then you also have the federal laws on top of that. You know, we've seen the problems that we've had even with medical marijuana in the states that have opted to pursue that. And I was supportive of medical marijuana use because I think it has medicinal purposes. But, you know, we're seeing a reluctance even in that area on physicians, healthcare providers to even get involved with that because of concerns of the illegalities. So I really haven't thought through what the legalities would be because it's not a concept that I support. I know there are those legislators in Albany that there are some that have spoken out in support of this. So they'd probably be better choice to ask than myself at this point.
John, have you given this thought?
Oh, absolutely. In Canada, they essentially received a research exemption so that they could do this. And Insight was, you know, operated temporarily. They were allowed to do it for, I think, a 2 to 3 year span. And then, you know, they had to be sort of recertified, if you will. But they didn't go through a formal, you know, clinical licensing process and those sorts of things. So I think it would, under the umbrella of, you know, being kind of a research experiment, I think something like this could happen. And I think the Department of Health would certainly know how to go about that. I want to say just one thing, if I can, about treatment. We are fully behind people going to treatment. At both of our syringe exchange programs, I think a lot of people know, we have dedicated staff that their entire job is to get people into treatment, to facilitate that entry. But here's the reality. 80% of the people that walk through the door to use the syringe exchange every day have been to treatment.
So what's not working?
I think that traditional treatment that does not use medication is not very effective at this point in history. I think programs that are based on the 12 steps, which is a good social support model, I don't think it's a great treatment model. If you had cancer and you went to your doctor's office and your doctor told you that he was going to use what was the state-of-the-art treatment 77 years ago, I think you'd have some serious questions about your physician's capabilities.
It seems when we talk about supervised injection sites that they are more about keeping people alive, not necessarily keeping them off of drugs. Is that true?
They're about a number of things. They're about teaching people how to inject properly so that they don't get things like heart infections. They're about talking to people about using safely, about reducing their drug use, about possibly going into detox or treatment. We certainly broach issues with them of, you know, do you have safe and secure housing? You know, are you eating correctly? You know, basic food, clothing, and shelter needs. We have support groups that meet. We offer people laundry facilities and a place where they can shower if that's a need. We are trying to prevent people from injecting next to a dumpster or in the library bathroom or in the local restaurant bathroom. You know, there's some really good things that can come out of this to make the community better and to help business owners. Because, look, nobody who's running a restaurant wants people shooting up in their bathroom. We don't want people injecting in the public library. And I will tell you, it happens. That's a problem, okay? We don't want injection materials bouncing around in the community. We want to be able to collect those and not have anybody exposed to them. We want to protect law enforcement and make sure that they're not getting stuck with needles. We want to have these folks access medical care. We're in the process of hiring some medical staff at our Ithaca location for just that purpose because, again, we'd rather address it there much more cheaply, save the taxpayers money, rather than having that person be hospitalized or go to the emergency room.
I know that the legislature recently, you know, passed several attempts to correct some of these issues with laws and regulations. Did that go far enough?
I think we did. We did a large package of bills this year, and we did a not quite as substantive, but a large package last year as well. And I think that it's a huge step in getting this going. I think we need to see where things shake out. But it's going to be a matter to have the dollars behind the initiatives that we're talking about. And that is, you know, some of the things we've done is to not allow insurance companies to require pre-approvals for certain inpatient stays at the outset or for certain types of medications such as the Suboxone to help. And those things go a long way. Certainly there's a lot of pushback from the insurance industry on that because when you add these types of things, that increases the cost of the insurance and what's being paid for, and everybody that's paying for insurance pays for that. I think this is truly a public health issue that insurances should cover these types of things, and it's never easy to try to get the buy-in from particularly the insurance industry to willingly go along with expanding these things. But I think we would certainly see savings on the back end by getting people off of their addictions and the social costs elsewhere.
John, anything to add here?
Yes. I think that the Senate and the Assembly have done an excellent job the last couple of years, and they've been very responsive, the governor as well. I think if we want effective treatment, we're going to have to do some work on targeting OASAS itself, the New York State Office of Alcoholism and Substance Abuse Services. My experience of them and many people's experience of them is that they are continuing to operate in a treatment model that is 30 to 40 years old, and they are resistant to changing things. And as a matter of fact, recently my organization looked into getting an OASAS license, crunched the numbers, and found out that we would probably be in the red and underwater if we chose to offer treatment based on the current reimbursement that's available. So I applaud the Senate and the Assembly for putting more money into long-term treatment and some of the other things that they have. But we need to do some work on the reimbursement models if we want more people to jump into the treatment provision game.
State Senator Tom O'Meara of Big Flats and John Barry of the Southern Tier AIDS Program, thank you both for joining me today.
Thank you for having us on.
Thank you, Crystal.
Next, a conversation about recovery. This is The Rush from WSKG News.
WSKG is on Twitter. Follow us at WSKG and join in the conversation from the latest in education and science or WSKG News. There's always something new to discover. WSKG on Twitter.
Welcome back to The Rush, Digging into Addiction from WSKG News. I'm Crystal Sarakis. Coming up, we talk to a scientist who explains what addiction does to your brain. But first, a look at addiction from a person who's been through it. Tracy Helton Mitchell is the author of the recent book, The Big Fix, Hope After Heroin. It's a story about rebuilding her life after a long bout with drug abuse. She says her first drug of choice was food.
In the 70s or in the 80s, there weren't a lot of fat kids, so I sort of opened myself up to a lot of teasing and bullying. That made me a very sort of angry, sort of, isolated person. I was very advanced in school, so then that was another set of things. And then when I wasn't really into even, experimenting with alcohol or marijuana. I had done a little bit of that as a teenager. But then when I was 17, I had my wisdom teeth pulled. And I just remember the feeling of not caring anymore, just for a brief few days while I was, healing. And I sort of bookmarked that feeling for later. And I had got involved in a relationship with this person who was really not a very good choice. And he was very abusive. And, when that relationship ended, I was just totally devastated. And I remember, wanting to escape my feelings. And so first it was alcohol, and then it was, my friends would get in their parents' medicine cabinets. They would have these leftover medications, or they would get they would break their arm and be prescribed something. So we'd sort of experiment with different opioids. About a year after I had started sort of experimenting with drugs, I tried heroin for the first time, and it was, an explosion after that.
What made you want to use a second time after you tried it for the first time?
The intense euphoria that it is like nothing I had experienced. I was a person who constantly thought all the time, was constantly in battle with myself, self-critical. And then for a moment, it was like all of that was relieved. And then very quickly, the solution then becomes the problem. I had experienced withdrawal. I didn't even know what it was. I had taken morphine for a few days, 4 days, and then my legs were twitching, and I was had this, fever. They call it the junkie flu. I didn't even know. I was very naive, and I didn't even really understand what was wrong with me. And I had begged my friend to suffocate me, and he said, "Oh, no, you're just kicking." And I was like, "Well, what is that?" I didn't even know about the withdrawal symptoms and what would happen to me.
Do you think that you were addicted from that first or second use?
I don't know if I was addicted necessarily, but I would say that psychologically, it was very powerful. It was a very powerful draw for me. I think if maybe things had been going differently in my life where I'd had more support or positive reinforcement or positive things going on in my life, maybe things could have turned out differently, but that wasn't the trajectory that my life was headed in.
I wonder if you can talk about what your life was like during that period when you were using.
Initially when I started using, like most people, I had a job and I was going to school. I was going to the University of Cincinnati, And then as my using sort of spiraled out of control when I, you know, I came out to San Francisco, I ended up being homeless. I was, you know, just a complete mess. I was living in and out of hotels, occasionally prostituting myself, just, you know, taking advantage of whoever and whatever situation I could to try to get more drugs. I just remember there was one night in particular that will always stay with me where, you know, I was standing outside. I was in this alley where I was sleeping. You know, a lot of times young people will sleep in little encampments together, and everyone was asleep except for me. And I was under the street light, and I was going through all my belongings, which lived in, you know, was in a shopping cart. I was standing there in the street light, and I thought to myself, you know, someday I'm going to go back to school and I'm going to get my life back. And there's absolutely no reason why I should have believed that was true, because everything around me said I was going to be murdered or I was going to die of an overdose or, you know, some kind of horrible infection. But for some reason, I kind of believed it. And then it was just another couple years of that where, you know, whatever moment of clarity completely escaped me. Because when you get to a certain point of, I don't really believe in a bottom, but when you get into a certain point of, you know, where things have spiraled out of control, I'm homeless, I have warrants, I have this drug problem, I'm completely separated from my family, I have no friends, I have all these medical problems. Like, where do you even start to the point where you feel like not even addressing it because it's magnified so horribly that it's just completely inconceivable that you could do anything to change your circumstances?
You mentioned that you don't really believe in a bottom, and of course that's one of the phrases that almost everybody uses when it comes to any kind of addiction. So why don't you believe in that concept?
Oh, because you can always go much lower. I mean, I've seen so many things in my addiction. Like when people talk about, oh, you reach a bottom, it's like, no, actually, I've seen women prostitute with colostomy bags, you know, oxygen tanks, you know, a woman getting her arm amputated, you know, because the flesh was hanging out of her arm from an infection she didn't take care of for like 6 months. When people imagine a bottom, they picture their son or their daughter spending a few nights out on the street, possibly losing their job, you know, being turned away from their friends and then somehow coming home. It's like, no, it can actually get much, much worse.
Now, was there one moment that you can look back on and say, that's where everything changed and that's where I was firmly committed to recovery?
When I started shooting up in the soles of my feet is when I said to myself, you know, I absolutely have to do something different or I'm going to die. But at the time, I didn't know exactly what that was. It took a few months for me to get some insight. I just remember having a suitcase packed in my closet and the police had been looking for me because I wasn't, you know, following up with my felony probation. I remember saying, well, when they arrest me, I'm gonna go to treatment. I'm gonna beg them to go to treatment because there wasn't a lot of options back then to get into any sort of help on your own. You had to either privately pay or go to jail. Those were pretty much the two options. And so one wasn't available to me. So I had said to myself, I'm gonna go to treatment and I'm gonna do whatever they say and try to do this for real. Just one time and see what happens. And that's exactly what I did.
Can you talk a little bit about what that process was for you?
Well, first you go through, as a person who uses opioids, you go through a 3 to 5 day period of intense physical sickness. You know, it's like the worst case of the flu you can imagine, where your legs are twitching, your eyes start watering, your nose is running. You have horrible digestive symptoms, throwing up, and then you can't sleep. And a lot of times you can't sleep for, you know, it can be up to a week where you're only sleeping a few hours at a time and waking up with these horrible leg cramps. And so then you go through what's called post-acute withdrawal symptom. And that can last, a few weeks, or that can last months, where it's almost like you feel like your best friend died because you have been artificially replacing your happy chemicals in your brain with heroin. And so your brain is now shut down production of its happy chemicals. You know, it's most a horrible feeling, or you feel nothing at all, which is equally bad because, you know, we might be in a rehab program or people around you like, oh, aren't you so happy that you quit using drugs? It's like, no, I kind of am not right now because I'm not in touch with myself. And then slowly over time, you start to feel things again. And the first things you might start to feel is sort of like a remorse or this horrible feeling inside of your gut, like, how could I have possibly did this to myself all this time? And you feel sort of the guilt and the shame. And, you know, I tell clients a lot of times, those in the early stages are really kind of useless emotions. Those are the things that cause people to relapse, is focusing on all the negative things that you've done. It's like you really have to start where you're at and start to build positive things into your life. And then when you have the emotional strength, go back and try to deal with some of the damage of the things that you've done. And so you truck along, you start to feel better maybe 30 days later, sometimes a couple weeks for some people. You might start laughing again, or you notice the bird chirping or the sun, you know, the sunset. And then you start to think about, what am I going to do with my life? And that's another set of, emotionally distressing things. When, you know, you haven't worked for an extended period of time, or, you know, perhaps you've destroyed every personal relationship that you've had. So then you start reconnecting with your community, with, you know, your family. And it's a slow uphill battle. And then, you know, one day, you know, it varies from person to person. You start to notice that things are actually really, truly getting better for you. And you just have to hang on until you get to that point.
The decision to get help is so very individual. How do we, as family, as friends, and as members of our community, offer help for something that is such an individual choice?
I think that the first step is really non-judgmental listening. I think that especially when people say heroin, it gives you sort of a reactionary feeling. So, you're killing yourself. It's like, well, they know that, but we have to kind of start where we're at with this process and listen to what different people need. I mean, the first step is literally making sure that people don't kill themselves, so they have access to naloxone. They are not, you know, getting soft tissue infections from dirty needles or hepatitis C or different things. And then there's the process of getting people into whatever rehabilitation services they're willing to participate in. Forcing things on people isn't necessarily, from a public health perspective, the best interventions. We want to try to guide people to where we are at, as opposed to pushing something onto someone.
I'd like to talk a little bit about Jake. He was a friend of yours when you were on the street. He was in the documentary Black Tar Heroin with you, and you saw him, that you write in your book, you saw him later at a point when you were both in recovery, and he was on methadone at the time, and it seemed to be working for him, but he wanted to get off of it because other people said he really wasn't clean as long as he was still on methadone.
Jake was a person who had multiple health issues, mental health issues. He was, you know, a very close friend of mine in our addiction. And so I was completely shocked when I ran into him and he told me, you know, I've completed a residential treatment program. I'm going to college. And he said that he was tapering off methadone because people in the 12-step meetings had told him that he wasn't clean. And it instantly tore at me because I thought, this is the best you've done in your entire life. You're, you know, you've had stable housing, a girlfriend, and why are you letting other people convince you that you're not clean? Because obviously, in the definition of what clean means to you or to anyone, really, it should be fine. There's nothing wrong with you. And so what had happened was he, you know, listened to other people. He got off methadone very, you know, quickly, and then he relapsed and he died. And I'd ran into him right after he had relapsed, and I had tried to convince him to go get back on the methadone treatment program. And it was very, very sad because I realized that opinions are not facts. So if my opinion is abstinence-based recovery is the only option, that is not actually a fact. Anyone in any phase of recovery can help. You can help another person. You can give a person a sandwich, a glass of water. Listening to a person non-judgmentally or assisting them with certain areas of their life is fine. But when we start getting to hiring counselors that have absolutely no training, their only training is based on their personal experience, your personal experience in your life can be very, very limited. So I don't discourage people from helping other people. It's when you start getting into professional advice, staying away from that is really critical.
In your work, do you also work with the families of users?
So I work with families on a voluntary basis. They contact me through my social media. They email me. A lot of times I get referrals from other people saying, would you be willing to talk to that person? I just try to link them either to information or sometimes they just need to get stuff off their chest, because I think that for families in particular of where their child or their niece, nephew, whoever it is using drugs, they're very, very isolated. And I know for in particular with my own mother, you know, she couldn't tell anyone that she had a daughter that was a heroin addict. It would have made her completely socially ostracized at the time. So she kept all that inside of her. You know, it must have been very, very painful for my mother when I look back, not having any kind of touchstones, letters, anything from me except for when I was in jail. So the family members face unique challenges that I'm not necessarily the expert on, but I just try to, you know, provide an ear for them and then direct them to other family groups that might be able to help them or just give them some basic information.
Do you find yourself saying a particular thing to them over and over?
Well, the first thing I say to them is breathe, because I think when you find out that someone that you love is using heroin, it's very, very frightening. Because the first thing they imagine is that person is going to die somewhere with, you know, a needle hanging out of their arm or in a bathroom, and they're not going to know. I mean, I have children myself, and I can only imagine that many of the parents feel that they somehow did something to make this happen. In the very end, it's the individual's choice, and they're not forcing them to use drugs. So I just try to, you know, be empathetic and dive into it and see where you're at with what's going on.
You've been clean for 18 years now. Is it easier today?
It is so much easier than it was. I would say that the challenges I face today are very, very different than the first 5 years. I would say there, you know, and there's research that shows this. Once you kind of get through the first 5 years, your chances of relapse are much smaller, because in the initial phases, you're just trying to get your life together. The first few years, you kind of have this fear that anything is going to happen and I'm going to slip and the needle is going to fall in my arm, or I'm going to end up using again. And that's not really what happened for me. Like, even if I wanted to use drugs now, there's so many barriers to that happening. You know, there's so many things in the way. Like, first of all, I have a conscience. And second of all, you know, I have these great things in my life. I've removed all of sort of the conduits to me going back down that road.
Why did you write the book?
So I wrote the book because I felt like there's not a lot of books on long-term recovery. You read these books. I've read them myself. It's like using, 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 great, using, 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 great. And it's like the last chapter, and then I quit. Yay. And then it's over. And then they don't really explain like how they did it. And actually, a lot of those books, then you find out later that that person went back to using drugs or whatever. So I have a lot of years behind me, and I have a lot of experiences. You know, I had a miscarriage, and they tried to prescribe me all these opioids, and I already had wanted to, you know, kill myself or whatever because I was so depressed. And then they're trying to give me all these opioids. So there's like practical things that you deal with on a daily basis in long-term recovery that I thought hadn't really been covered. And then also really speaking to what it's like to be a woman who's had sort of a shady past and in sex work and then got into a healthy relationship. I think that's a lot that's, you know, missing is the hope. I think we have a huge deficit of hope in this country. I mean, it's hard to actually gauge how many active heroin users there are because so many people are using in secret, but the vast majority of people who use heroin quit. And I think that we don't emphasize that enough, and we don't tell people, you know, you really can't quit. Like, when I send these emails to people, you really can't quit. Like, absolutely, you can quit. And no one says that to them. If I could do it, anyone can do it.
You've talked a lot about what we need to do to fix this. Are there things that we're getting right?
People are really waking up to harm reduction. And people are really trying to, the families in particular, are organizing and creating communities. If the opposite of addiction is connection, really connecting people back into the community and connecting the families is so important. I mean, I would say, it's going to sound really strange, but like the first person that I really communicated with was actually my cat to a certain extent. You know, learning from my from animals and actually creating a connection with someone else made it so much easier for a person who'd been so isolated then to connect to other people. And then slowly I started letting other people into my life. I think, you know, building a connection wherever you can find it, connecting with, you know, connecting with nature, connecting with a social group, going back to school, and then also the movement to really give, you know, people who've been convicted of drug-related crimes back their civil rights. I mean, I was convicted of a felony for a $20 bag of drugs, and I currently, in California, I have the right to vote, but there's many states in the United States where I'd be completely disenfranchised from my civil rights. So, you know, it's really powerful that communities are saying, like in Massachusetts, where they're saying, we want to have treatment before jail. And I think that that movement is really going to make a huge difference here in the United States.
Well, Tracy Helton Mitchell, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks.
That was Tracy Helton Mitchell, author of the book The Big Fix, Hope After Heroin. After the break, your brain on drugs. This is The Rush.
Trying to stay up to date with all the wonderful works that WSKG does for the community? Well, find us on Facebook, from Hard Tack to educational news.
This trigonometry lesson is supposed to get Williams ready for the
jazz legends.
There's only, in the Western scale, there's only 12 notes.
In the latest local politics.
This is WSKG News. District attorneys around.
You never know what you're going to find. Like us and join in on the conversation with your comments and questions.
You're listening to The Rush, Digging into Addiction, from WSKG News. I'm Crystal Sirakis. Turning now to the biology of addiction, what happens to your brain on drugs? Well, Dr. Ruben Baller is a health scientist with the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Dr. Baller, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure.
What happens in the brain when it becomes addicted to opioids?
Well, there's nothing particularly specific about opioids. The process is quite a generic project, the process that happens with any drug of abuse to one extent or another. We can think of addiction as if it were really a learning process. Actually, at the synapse level, at the level of the neurons and the connecting points between neurons, the process is very similar to learning. And if you ever learn how to ride a bicycle, then you know how difficult it would be to unlearn how to ride a bicycle. This is pretty much what happens with addiction. It's something that we learn. It leaves very profound marks in the learning processes of the brain. And this is why it's so difficult to unlearn and why relapses are so frequent, because this is something that the brain learns very profoundly, very powerfully, and it's very difficult to get rid of.
If you have one person who can take painkillers and they have no issue, and then you might have a person who takes them and becomes addicted, what's the difference between those two people?
Well, there are many, many differences that we call inter-individual differences that make up for very different values in their individual risk. Some of those factors have to do with genetics. We knew all along for many years that there is a very heavy genetic load that we bring with our hereditary factors. About 50% of the overall risk of abusing a substance, of gravitating towards substances of abuse, and then becoming addicted can be ascribed to genetic factors. Biological risk, an underlying biological risk for addiction, is one of the things that today we know doctors should ask for when planning for a long-term pain management for chronic pain. But then there is another, about half, that's a rule of thumb, of factors that are outside of our genes that have to do with our environments, our social milieu, our parental style, our neighborhoods, all sorts of factors, and you can list thousands of these little factors that are outside of our biology that have a very profound impact on that risk. So it's really the convergence and the confluence of all those factors that will determine the individual risk for addiction.
If you compare a non-addicted person's body to an addicted person's body, what differences exist?
The main differences that you can find is in the way that circuitry works in the brain. The circuitry that has to do with addiction begins in a very primitive part of the brain that we share with reptiles, and it has to do with all these behaviors that we call either attraction or avoidance. Chronic drug use begins to cause plastic changes, long-term changes in the part of the brain that processes reward. The problem with addiction is not just the reward processes that become corrupted with the chronic use of drug, but addiction really entails this ever-expanding wave of dysfunction, that it really starts in the processing in the circuitry of reward, but it then begins to compromise other circuits having to do with memory, with the way we regulate emotions, with the way we process motivation, and eventually in the really addicted, the heavy duty addicted individuals, those that have been using drugs for a long, long time, it can really compromise the parts of the brain that are engaged in higher cognitive function, particularly the prefrontal cortex, which is that part of the brain in charge of allowing us to make proper decisions, to ponder the consequences of our actions, to inhibit our prepotent impulses. In a way, this is the part of the brain that is in charge of our free will. So this is impairments in this area are those impairments that allow us to say that when addiction reached that point, we are really talking about the bona fide disease of the brain.
And when we're talking about addiction, a lot of people say it's just a matter of willpower. But what you're saying, there are fundamental changes in the brain itself that you have to deal with.
What we are saying now, based on many studies doing imaging of the brain, looking at the neurophysiology of the brain, looking at the genetic factors that put some people at much higher risk than others, is that it's not a moral flaw, it's an operational flaw. These modules that are supposed to work in tandem and in proper balance are now out of balance, which even though it begins with a voluntary action of beginning to use a drug for the first time, it's really a Russian roulette, and it's impossible to know, very difficult to predict, who will then become onto a path, a trajectory that will lead to full-blown addiction.
I want to go back to something you said a minute ago when you talked about the ever-expanding wave of dysfunction. What does that look like biologically? Does it mean fewer synapses or more?
It's not fewer or more. It's really, we're going back to the first concept that I brought up, which is about learning. The brain is a very plastic organ, and the way we design our brain during development is really taking synapses out, taking points of contact that are not used, and adding new ones that are used. Those that are not used are lost, are weakened, and those that we use over and over again become strengthened. So this is the process of pruning and sculpting of the brain, particularly active during development. So this is a process, in a way, of learning. This is how the brain learns, by designing circuitry that is a function of the experience. The experience really shapes the architecture of the brain. So it's just that the brain of an addict becomes shaped by that experience in a very powerful way. You can see that in imaging studies. If you look at, for example, when we go back to the very center of addiction, of the addiction process, the beginning, we talk about the reward centers of the brain. There you can see, if you look at the receptors that are supposed to bind dopamine, we see a reduction in the level of dopamine receptors. And this is a way of the brain, in that particular part of the brain, the reward centers, a way of trying to adapt to the very loud noise of dopamine that the drugs tend to cause. And it's like covering your ears when you are confronted with a very loud noise in a radio, for example. The result of that is that the person now is less sensitive, not only to the drug, which is an artificial reward, but also to all sorts of natural rewards, like food, going out with friends, sex. So this is the beginning of the addicted trajectory. When you really begin to feel impaired in your ability to feel not just drug rewards, but any sort of reward.
So then age must influence what effects drugs will have on your brain. Is it easier to get addicted at a younger age?
Absolutely, because you can think of the young brain as a brain that is being programmed. Everything that the young person is doing goes into that program as lines of code, if you want. Drug exposure, watching TV, using the cell phone, doing sports, everything. Everything becomes part of the experience, which eventually goes down into some kind of a line of a code and into a program. So the problem is that the active period where we humans write those programs, those developmental programs in the brain, is during the pre-adolescence, adolescence, and young adulthood, somewhere between 12 years of age and 23, 25 years of age. There is this active peak of brain programming, if you will. So using a drug during that window of vulnerability really is like a shuffling or reshuffling the letters in the keyboard that the person is using to program the brain. Now, if you reshuffle the keyboard after the program is written, that is when you're an adult, you can expect some problems running the program. That's, we call that intoxication. That would be temporary because the program is written. However, if you reshuffle the letters in the keyboard while you are actively programming your brain or writing those lines of code, you can expect some glitches or bugs to be embedded in the program. Those will be much harder to get rid of. And that's a way of explaining why the young brain, which is actively developing, is so much more at risk of becoming addicted later on in life.
Some of my research I've read says that you get addicted faster to opioids. Is that true?
The liability, the addiction liability of different drugs differ. For example, if you look at the entire population of the United States, about half of the population is exposed at some point or another regularly to alcohol. Only 10% of those, roughly, will show any signs of addiction, dependence to alcohol. Tobacco is more addictive, about 30%. Opiates are somewhat more addictive, probably 50 to 60% range if they are misused. So the addiction liability really varies with the drug. Different drugs have different levels of liability. And that has to do with the pharmacology, the way they interact with this dopamine circuitry. All drugs of abuse, in one way or another, directly or indirectly, have this confluence. They affect, they impact the dopaminergic transmission, the way that the brain uses dopamine to process reward and predict rewards. So different drugs have different potencies and different mechanisms whereby they do this. And that's really reflected in their different addiction liabilities.
Where do scientists still disagree about the biology of addiction?
That's a very tough question. Really, I would think that it's in the details. And perhaps there is some disagreement as to how much of a disease is and whether volition, how do we understand consciousness and pleasure. We have the concept of the heart problem. Where is pleasure encoded? And what is the actual role of dopamine in terms of predicting the differential between expectation, anticipation, and pleasure? So these are really details.
What do you still want to know about addiction?
I see addiction not just as a disease, but also as a symptom. As a symptom that reflects different things for different people. For some people, for example, who start early, it just reflects, exposes this tendency to take risks when you're young. It's a symptom of somebody who doesn't have access to mental health services and gravitates towards alcohol or sedatives to treat, to self-medicate. Obviously, that's a misuse of a drug, but a lot of people have these comorbid conditions, and in a system that in which many people fall through the cracks, it's not that uncommon to find people who are forced to self-medicate and they gravitate towards drugs in that way. So addiction is not just a disease, but it's also a symptom of cracks in our social system, in our fabric of mental and physical healthcare. So I would like to for science to really address, and policymakers to really address those gaps, because when we are confronted with somebody who's addicted, it's already late. It's too late, and it's very difficult to revert. I would like to see more resources, more research into that part, perhaps less sexy part of the equation, which is prevention. Let's get serious about prevention at all levels of the equation.
Dr. Baller, thank you so much for talking with me.
It was really my pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity.
That was Dr. Reuben Baller with the National Institute on Drug Abuse. And that ends the show. Thank you for listening to The Rush, Digging into Addiction. You can find these interviews and other addiction coverage online. Go to wskgnews.org/rush. The show is produced by me and Brett Jaspers, who also edited the show. I'm Crystal Sirakis. This is WSKG News.
The Rush, Digging into Addiction, is made possible through a grant from the Binghamton Rotary Charities and the generous support of listeners like you. Thanks for your support.